most fun I ever had filming. It remains the world's first mockumentary, before Zelig and before Spinal Tap. I'm glad to see it has a continuing life, and I'm proud of it. As George said in his book, I Me Mine, what should have happened is that the Bonzos and the Beatles should have turned into one great Ruttle band with all the pythons and had a laugh. The Ruttles told the story so much better than the usual boring documentary. Try and see that film. That is a recommendation, rather like saying, don't bother me, see my lawyer. He will explain everything. Many years later, I made a very inexpensive sequel called The Ruttles 2, Can't Buy Me Lunch, where I interviewed celebrities about the effects of the Ruttles on them. James Taylor, Clint Black, Graham Nash, David Bowie, Salman Rushdie, and the wonderful Gary Shandling, who made me laugh so much when he said, Hard Day's Rut, I loved Hard Day's Rut. I loved Hard Day's Rut. That scene when they came off the train and the Nazis were there and they... Wait, they came off the train and... I'm sorry, I think I'm confusing Hard Day's Rut a little bit with Schindler's List. He was a brilliant man, and I miss him. For sheer cheek, though, Tom Hanks took the prize for beginning to cry as he remembered the Ruttles breaking up. He had been mocked for weeping when he won an Oscar, and this self-parody was just too delicious. Chapter 12, The Miracle of Brian. The Miracle of Brian is that it got made at all, which was entirely due to the generosity of George Harrison. Asked why he mortgaged his Henley home to pay for the entire $4.5 million budget of Monty Python's Life of Brian, he said, because I wanted to see the movie. It's still the most anyone has ever paid for a cinema ticket. The idea for Brian had sprung from an ad-lib I made at the opening of the Holy Grail in New York in April 1975. Journalist: Mr. Idle, what is your next film going to be? Me: Jesus Christ, Lust for Glory. Interestingly, the pythons began to take my gag seriously. Gilliam and I improvised disgracefully on the theme one drunken evening in Amsterdam, using highly blasphemous jokes, for which I blamed the beer. But it was John Cleese who really liked the idea of doing something about religion. Nobody had ever done anything on the subject. It was a big blank space for comedy. We began by doing research, reading biblical history, the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the Apocrypha, some of the weirder books that never made it into the Bible. We screened some of the hilarious Hollywood movies made about Christianity. The Robe, The Shoe, Ben-Him, Ben-Hur, you know, the sort of thing. They were magnificent mainly for the appalling acting of major Hollywood stars that made us laugh a lot. John Wayne: surely this man was the son of God. We agreed early on you couldn't knock Christ. How can you attack a man who professes peace to all people, speaks out for the meek, heals the poor, and cures the sick? You can't. Comedy's business is some kind of search for truth. Clearly, this was a very great man, leaving aside for a minute his potential divinity. No, the problem with Christianity was the followers, who would happily put each other to death at the drop of a dogma. You could be burned alive if you didn't believe Christ was actually in the communion wafer. What, cannibalism? And they are still bickering about whether gluten-free bread constitutes the real Christ or not. I mean, it's nuts. Christ admired, saved, and protected women. The followers denied them, locked them up, and insisted in about the 12th century that the clergy become celibate, with highly predictable results from popes shagging their daughters to paedophilia. What we needed for our purposes was a surrogate for Christ. So Brian was born. For a while, he was just one of the followers. He was given the job of trying to book a table for the Last Supper. Sorry, mate, it's Seder, we're fully booked. No, we can't do a table for 13. I can give you one of 6 and then another for 7 over by the window. Why don't you want to use both sides of the table? At this stage, Brian was just a writer, like the other followers, who gave the Messiah tips on his speeches. Lose the bit about the meek, they'll be too timid to turn up anyway. hit them with a couple of beatitudes. The parable about the Samaritans plays good. Render a bit unto Caesar so as not to offend the Romans. And then end with the trick of changing the water into wine. That's always very popular. Everybody has a good drink and you're home and dry. People say, oh, you never make fun of Mohammedans. And of course not. We're not Muslims. We were brought up as Christians. I was sent to church twice every Sunday from the age of 7 to 19. And I loved the language of the King James Bible. I must have heard it read aloud at least 3 times in chapel. At the age of 14, I was confirmed by the bishop of something, and I even for a while was a believer. But when a boy asked our padre at school whether he thought Jesus was the Son of God, he surprisingly answered, well, no, old bean. That from the padre. So we had earned the right to examine Christianity, and we treated it seriously. People who thought we were attacking Jesus clearly never saw the movie. He is in the film twice. Once at his birth, where it is made very clear that Brian is born next door, and the 3 wise men have come to the wrong stable. And once at the Sermon on the Mount, where the crowd at the back, quite reasonably, can't hear very well.
I think he said, blessed are the Greek.
Our movie became about the followers, the interpreters, the exploiters and the profiteers, the people who seek to control those who wish to believe. A perfectly legitimate target for satire, and one appreciated by many people in the church, who understood the joke is not about Christ, but about man. Or woman. Yeah, all right, Stan. To avoid cheap blasphemy gags and really examine the subject, Brian became a man who suffers the awful fate of being mistaken for the Messiah. A terrible nightmare. No matter what he does or says, he cannot refute it. I'm not the Messiah. Only a true Messiah would deny his divinity. Well, what chance does that give me? Fuck off. How shall we fuck off, O Lord? Brian, of course, is a tragedy. Pursued by his followers and wanted by the Romans, he's captured and sentenced to death by crucifixion. Then the major form of execution used throughout the Roman Empire. Well, what'd they do to me? Oh, you'll probably get away with crucifixion.
Get away with crucifixion?
Yeah, first offence.
Mass crucifixions were common. 2,000 of Spartacus' followers were crucified along the Appian Way. Some were even set alight, an early form of street lighting. There is nothing special about crucifixion. In a different century, Christ would have been hanged, and his followers would all now wear nooses. But in March 1976, it gave us a big problem with the script. With Brian and many of his followers headed for death, how on earth were we going to end the film? I had a light bulb moment. Well, it has to be with a song, I said. What? A song, sung from the crosses, a ridiculously cheery song about looking on the bright side, like a Disney song, maybe with a little whistle. And they laughed. Like a sort of Spartacus musical, said someone. They can dance too, said Gilliam, with a gleam in his eye. And they laughed at the idea that it could become a big production number. And then everybody said, that's it, we've got our ending, hooray, let's go home for the day. So it went into the script as I'm looking on the bright side. And I said, I'll write it up. And I took home some notes I scribbled on the back of the script, got my guitar out, and it didn't take very long at all. The first thing I wrote was the whistle, G, D minus 7th, A minus 7th, E7, using jazz chords that I'd learned from the Mickey Baker guitar course. It took me maybe 20 minutes to sort out the basic shape of the song, using major sixths and minor sevenths, and the very useful diminished chord, which George Harrison told me the Beatles called the sneaky chord. The verse also appeared very quickly. A minor seventh, sneaky, G major sixth, A minor seventh, sneaky, G, and the words followed quite simply. After about an hour, I had to stop and collect Carrie, who was now 3 years old, from nursery school. And I remember driving home in a hurry so I could play him what I'd written. He really liked the song with its whistling chorus. I changed the lyric to always look on the bright side of life to fit my tune. And I recorded it then and there on a little Sony tape recorder, which I still have, and played it the next day to the rest of the chaps. They seemed to like it. I had been trying to persuade the Pythons to go out to the West Indies in January 1978 for our writing fortnight, instead of staying in freezing London. John Cleese was in favour of it, but Michael was all Alan Bennett-y.
Oh, I don't think I can do that. Oh, I don't want to go abroad. Oh, it's so far. Oh, it's a waste of money.
And neither of the Terriers was keen. I wanted to show Tiny a Barbados, and we'd been invited to spend Christmas in Heron Bay at American UN Ambassador Marietta Tree's villa with Ricky Fattah and Penelope Tree. We were being offered the Pink Cottage, the most beautiful coral stone guest house right on the beach. A total dream. No way I wasn't going. Shortly before we left, Mick Jagger rang me. Was I going to Barbados for Christmas? Yes. Did I know Brian Ferry? Yes, a bit. Would I take Brian with me? What? No. Oh. Well, then, could he come? Why? I've just run off with Jerry, Brian's girlfriend, and I need to hide from the papers. Oh, all right, then. We arranged to hide him and Jerry Hall on the other side of the island in a little village appropriately named Bathsheba. There they hid away happily in Matilda, a tiny cottage, though the owner said they broke the bed. I would have expected nothing less. Jerry was a very friendly Texan lass, and when they came over to Heron Bay, she climbed on the back of a cow in a field behind the house. "Careful, Jerry," I said. "Ah, no need to worry. We ride 'em all the time in Texas." At which the cow took off at high speed with Jerry on top. Unfortunately, the cow was tethered, so at the end of its rope it came to an abrupt halt. Jerry didn't. She wasn't hurt, except by our laughing so much. Christmas in Barbados was wonderful, with all the Santas in the sun and the wispy cotton wool snow, which is as near to the real thing as I ever like to come. With January approaching and the appeal of winter London paling, I tried one more plea to the pythons to come out. We could all stay at Heron Bay. It would be brilliant. It would be productive. It would be warm. Amazingly, they agreed. Graham has spent Christmas in detox, fighting off alcohol. The sun would do him good. John was doing some kind of tax year abroad. So out they came. It actually made a lot of sense for everybody to get away and stay together in one house for 2 weeks. We could concentrate on the script and talk about it while we dined and swam and relaxed. So it indeed proved. We had a very efficient and very pleasant time staying at the Palladian Villa right on the beach in St. James. It was great to think that Ronald Tree's friend, Winston Churchill, had sat writing in the same splendid drawing room open to the sea breezes, and that Mr. Brown, who served us all cocktails, had also served the great man. Keith Moon, the Who's drummer, followed us to Barbados. Like Graham, he was on Himinevrin, a dangerous drug used to combat the effects of alcohol withdrawal. Graham had wanted Keith to play the lead in his movie, The Odd Job, but the producers wouldn't let him, and instead we had offered him a part in Brian. I'd met Keith on a very improbable night in London, where I hung out with him and Lionel Bart, the writer of the musical Oliver. They were great pals and quite an act, and Keith was inspiringly generous, once setting off from his home in his dressing gown, driving his lawnmower to the nearest old people's home, holding aloft 2 magnums of champagne, then sitting and playing the piano with them for hours, singing old favourites. Now he would wait patiently for us to play on the beach at lunchtime. Even in the West Indies, we worked office hours, and it was sweet to see him in the evening playing Scrabble with Cleese and Chapman, adding the word cat to their very long words. Mick Jagger also came to dinner with Jerry, and we played charades, at which he was terrific. It was a wonderful time and very productive. We finished writing the final draft of Life of Brian in January 1978. One man who was extremely interested in what we were up to was Barry Spikings, a movie executive from EMI, who had a house nearby, and he kept on at me to show him the script, which I did as soon as they all left. He called me the next day and said he'd fallen out of bed laughing and he wanted to make it. So immediately EMI bought it and everything was hunky-dory. We were scheduled to shoot the film in the autumn in Tunisia. Sets were being built, costumes designed, locations scouted, all the millions of tiny things that need doing on a movie before the actors swan in and complain about everything. When we got the shocking news that EMI had pulled out, Lord Bernard Delfont had read the script, and he and his brother Lou Grade were adamant that EMI should make no such film. which he said was obscene and sacrilegious. We were totally in the hole for a lot of money, as we'd blithely used our own to get the production started, confident in the knowledge that EMI would pay us back. Now they denied all such responsibility. We had no choice but to sue them to recover our costs. It was a simple case and didn't take long, but one of the clauses of the settlement is that I'm not allowed to tell you who had to pay for everything. So I won't. Let's just say that it wasn't us. And I rather cheekily stuck a reference to Lord Delphont into the play-out of Brightside. I told them, Bernie, I said, they'll never make their money back. Now all we had to do was find another backer. John Goldstone and I set off optimistically for New York, where we met several financial people who looked at us as if we were trying to sell them Springtime for Hitler. We got nowhere, not even a tickle of interest. The same in Hollywood. No one was prepared to pay for a movie, quote, sending up religion. It was quite depressing as the clock was ticking in Tunisia, where everything was on hold. From time to time I called George back in England and he would say, I'm getting the money, I'm going to find the money. But I never really believed him because I didn't think anyone, not even a Beatle, could come up with $4 million privately. When I showed it to our old producer friend Michael White, he practically passed out at the figure. It was 10 times the amount we'd raised for the Holy Grail. Still, we persisted in Hollywood, but to no effect. It was a total no. What could we do? What were we going to tell the others? Ring, ring. It was George. I've got the money, he said. We're making the film. Incredibly, he'd mortgaged Friar Park, his home in Henley, to pay for the entire budget. A quite extraordinary act of generosity. Dennis O'Brien, his wily Bialystock, arranged for the film to become a tax loss. They formed a new company, Handmade Films, and we were on. A miracle indeed, for without George, Life of Brian would never have been made. He visited us on the set in Tunisia, and when he asked me how it was going, I grumpily muttered something about how between John and Michael it was difficult getting on screen. He said, imagine what it was like with Lennon and McCartney trying to get studio time. Say no more. John had really wanted to play Brian, and Michael too had been dropping hints about the role, but it was clear to anybody, i.e. me, that Graham was far and away the best choice. He'd conquered alcohol, and like poor Keith Moon, who had succumbed to the effects of himinevrin and alcohol, which are lethal, and died in Harry Nielsen's flat in Mayfair on September the 7th, 1978. Keith was supposed to be in our movie, and I hugged him the night he died. We were both attending Paul McCartney's opening of the Buddy Holly story, and he came racing across and began spouting his lines from Brian as a mad prophet, and I shall at the time be monstrous things. He was terrific in his Robert Newton voice, and I said, yes, yes, Keith, that's great, save it for next week. Sadly, after the movie that night, he took a glass of champagne, and with alcohol and a little bit of food, that was that. He choked to death in the same bed where Mama Cass had died. The very next day, September the 8th, a few days before we left for location in Tunisia, I recorded Brightside at Chapel of Bond Street. John Altman had arranged it for a small orchestra with a nice swing jazz feel, and the Fred Tomlinson singers stood in for the absent Pythons. At the end, I put on a vocal, but wasn't happy with it. It was too straight, and it bothered me. In Tunisia, we played the track for the crew during a break, and I suddenly realised what was missing. It needed Mr. Cheeky to sing it. He was a cheery Cockney character I was playing, loosely based on our Sparks. We loved these Lee Electric lighting guys, who would do anything for us, and remained ridiculously optimistic in all sorts of distressing circumstances. They were also famous for their practical jokes. Once, on location with us in Devon, they'd taken one of their crew, who'd passed out from too much beer, and put him in his hotel bed on the hotel lawn, with all the hotel room furniture around him, so when he woke up in the morning, he was in his room, but outside. They were great, and they clearly influenced us. Crucifixion? No, freedom for me. They said I could go free and live on an island somewhere. Oh, right, well, that's jolly good. Off you go, then. Nah, I'm only pulling your leg. It's crucifixion, really. Now that I knew Mr. Cheeky should be singing the song, I asked Garth, the sound recordist, if we could get a new vocal onto the track. That night, I took a bottle of Buca a high-octane local spirit of figs containing between 36 and 40 degrees of alcohol, into his bedroom at the Unit Hotel in Monastir. We stuck mattresses round the walls, and with him lying on the floor with a boom mic, John Goldstone giggling in a corner, and me swinging on the booker, I really let rip with the cheeky character, and the song suddenly came to life. The single is still just a take of me singing live in a hotel bedroom in Tunisia. Chapter 13. The British Empire Strikes Back. Strange things kept happening to me in the 70s. At some point, Python had become not so much hot as cool. Because of that, I met a lot of very interesting people. I didn't seek them out. They found me. What am I supposed to say? Fuck off, Keith Richards. I'm not coming upstairs with you to sing till dawn in Rome. No, Mick Jagger, I will not come with you to the Monte Carlo Grand Prix. Bugger off, Bowie, who wants to join you on a yacht in the Caribbean? Heroes had become friends. Once you're in the circus, you're all in the circus, and of course it turns out that they are real people too, and have a sense of humour, which we had effectively tickled. Celebrity fans became even more noticeable after I became friends with George Harrison. A beetle and a python is a fairly unbeatable combination. I mean, look at the picture ping-ponging around the internet. Somebody sends it to me on Twitter every 3 months or so. It's my kitchen door in St. John's Wood. Through this same door, George had brought Eric Clapton to meet me. Eric kindly gave me a rock fossil. I hope I refrained from making the obvious joke. We all then went on to the Hammersmith Odeon to watch Bob Marley, where we sat on the stage next to the singers. Does Wow hack it? They were smoking the most enormous spliffs backstage, so I think the concert started 2 years late. But what is this picture telling us, except that Harrison Ford is obviously completely happy, and even the young, sweet, and slightly insecure Mark Hamill is having a good time. I'm coming through the door with a beard and a silver disc award for a Python album, but which and when and why? It was taken by the legendary rock and roll photographer Lynn Goldsmith, who was staying with the cast's co-star, Carrie Fisher, in our house off Abbey Road. But what the hell is going on? Champagne has already been poured, and the evening promises to get rowdy. Rarely did such promises go unfulfilled. The most memorable was an impromptu party that featured the return of the Booker. In fact, not only did it help make one scene in a movie, now it helped mar one scene in another. I had brought back a bottle of this lethal brew from Tunisia for a rainy day. And this particular day, it was pissing down. I'd met the delightful Carrie Fisher in New York while doing Saturday Night Live. She was utterly adorable, smart as a whip, funny and beautiful, and all the guys were crazy about her. She gave me a ride up Fifth Avenue in her little silver Mercedes, flipped on the stereo, and began improvising scenes from Noel Coward. She rented our house in St. John's Wood while she was filming The Empire Strikes Back. And one day I found both her and Harrison Ford very despondent. They were filming at Elstree, which is not the end of the world, but you can see it from there. Shooting long days on a special effects movie can be tedious for an actor, as I found out for myself on The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, where I chewed my own foot off. I got better. This day they were so down that I said, "You need my special remedy," and I brought out the Booker rocket fuel, which I'd used to sing my vocal to Brightside in the hotel room in Monastir. "This will definitely cheer you up," I said. It did. A party broke out, and if you can believe this, all of the Rolling Stones turned up. I, of course, pretended to the Star Wars folk that this was no big deal and happened all the time. But it began an epic night, which ended only at 6 a.m. when the cars came to pick up the actors for work, and the Stones sloped off to hang upside down in their caves. When I saw The Empire Strikes Back, I was so proud. The scene they shot that morning bears the scars of the evening. Carrie lurches out of a spaceship to meet Billy Dee Williams and says, "Hi." Harrison is still clearly drunk. I remain inordinately proud of the scene I spoiled and hope that one day George Lucas will forgive me. My time in the early 70s was often pure rock and roll. Sitting with Ronnie Wood in his Malibu colony rental, we would be suddenly swept up by Neil Young and taken for a ride in his enormous customized tour bus with its exquisite hand-carved wooden interior. There were glimpses of the California governor, Jerry Brown, quietly dating Linda Ronstadt. What a strange world it was. Ronnie Wood, naughty and always beaming, Keith, laconic, Mick, whirling like a dervish. Mick was always very funny about me and would send me up in an impeccable northern accent by saying, "And now, ladies and gentlemen, a man who has spent the last few years entertaining the British public in a short wig and a funny moustache." The party went on everywhere. One minute we were at Studio 54 in New York, the next on Dodie Fiat's yacht in Monte Carlo. Mick had driven me, Tanya and Jerry to the Monaco Grand Prix from Bill Wyman's house in St. Paul de Vence, where we were all staying. It was only an hour or two before the race, and I wondered where on earth he was going to park. "Parking," he said contemptuously. "Don't worry about that." We drove right to the heart of the race, by the Monte Carlo Casino. Police were everywhere. "Ready, everyone," said Mick. "One, two, three." And we simply got out of the car. "Good job it's rented," said Mick with a naughty smile, as the Monegasque police towed away his car. Parking, indeed. He was instantly grabbed by Regine, the New York nightclub queen, and within seconds we were sipping champagne at the Moët Chandon top table at the Hôtel de Paris, while French executives looked at us puzzled. The Grand Prix was deafening, the cars racing through the canyons below, shifting gears noisily. We leaned over them on balconies. "Who's winning?" Andy Warhol asked me, and I was very proud of my reply. "The red car, Andy." At the Cannes Film Festival that followed, we had a loud and pissy lunch at the Hotel du Cap with George and Olivia and Ringo. The terrace was packed with celebrities. "Look," someone said, "there's David Begelman." Begelman was a top studio executive who'd been an agent and was currently in the middle of a big scandal for forging his client Cliff Robertson's signature on his paychecks. I approached his table with a pen. "Excuse me, Mr. Begelman," I said. "Big fan. May I have Cliff Robertson's autograph?" On this trip with George and Olivia, we followed their friend Barry Sheen, the British motorbike champion, down to the French Grand Prix at the Paul Ricard circuit, where he duly won the 750cc motorcycle race, going impossibly fast and low around corners. "I saw you guys," he said, "and I wanted to wave, but I didn't have time to take my hand off the accelerator." "He saw us? In the crowd? Jesus!" You met all sorts at George's. I met a strange Peter Sellers who kept disappearing upstairs with a Swedish model. I think amyl nitrate was the cause of his dangerous complexion, and he would soon die for 4 minutes in L.A., though mercifully he was brought back to life, at least for the time being. Terry Southern, a Texan writer who wrote The Magic Christian, Candy, and Easy Rider, was a friend of Mick's, and he always carried around a shoebox of little vials and random loose pills that he would casually offer. "I don't think so, thanks, Terry," said Mick, as we stood in a light snowfall somewhere in Greenwich Village. "What are they?" asked Tanya. "I don't know. Take one," Terry said. "No, thanks," she said wisely. We went to smart opening night parties. Dolly Parton's first performance in New York at the Bottom Line on May the 14th, 1977, and lots of Saturday Night Live parties. I hosted the show 4 times in the 70s and marvelled that they could write anything. So fucked up did they get. Python always wrote office hours. The idea that he would try to write comedy while under the influence of anything was anathema to us. On Tuesday nights, on SNL, they would write all night, the offices reeking with the scent of marijuana. The host was expected to stay up and hang with them, as they got more stupefied and less inspired. Rewrites were unheard of. They went straight from pitch to set design. I loved the cast, particularly Dan Aykroyd and Gilda Radner, though they were all sweet and friendly. Belushi was very protective of Tanya and gave me warnings not to leave her. As if. I hosted the classic SNL show where Belushi did Dueling Joe Cockers, and that was some party afterwards. I remember writing "Good night, Joe" on his arm with a Sharpie as he lay peacefully passed out on the floor of a New York apartment. The last time I hosted SNL, on October the 10th, 1979, Bob Dylan was the musical guest, and he was going through his Christian phase with a brilliant album, Slow Train Coming. But he seemed very paranoid. He'd get off the elevator at the Essex House Hotel on our floor and then stay with me while he asked Tanya to go up one flight of stairs and make sure there was no one outside his door. There never was. I tried a joke. We could arrange for someone if you like. But nothing. He was highly aware of all that went on around him. John Candy and I were once guest appearing in the Wilbury Twist promo video, and I was placed by the director behind Bob Dylan. It's normal in these circumstances when filming to lean slightly left or right to find the camera. I leaned right, Dylan leaned right. I leaned left, he leaned left. He was preternaturally aware of where I was behind him and determined to stay in front. He seemed to have extrasensory vision. I was impressed and gave up. Hey, it was their video. One other guest on my last SNL show was the strangely weird and wonderful Andy Kaufman. I'd met him a couple of times and went to see his show in New York, where I had very much enjoyed him. During the intermission, he went off stage and left his mic on, and you could hear him throughout the interval trying to persuade this poor girl backstage to give him a blowjob. I loved his Mighty Mouse bit, and no one ever did a better or more unexpected Elvis. On SNL, he arrived with Bob Zemuda, and this was the first time he did his notorious wrestling women act on TV. They brought on an entire wrestling ring, and Zemuda was the referee. Andy baited the women in the audience, boasting he could beat any woman there, saying horrible sexist things about their role and place in society. God, man, woman, dog. Not surprisingly, he had several angry women takers from the audience, keen to wrestle with him. I was on set, racing to change costumes for my next sketch, when I saw one woman Andy was heading toward. He was going to choose her. I ran forward to the stage manager. Joe, I said, you can't name take her. Why not? She's pregnant. My mother in me, the outraged health visitor, had intervened. I'm glad to say they stopped her. We took my mother to see Andy Kaufman when we met her in San Francisco. She was on a world cruise. It was her third time. She said to me, I wish there was somewhere else to go. She'd already been to Egypt, where she said, I saw the tomb of Carmen Tutu. My favourite of hers was when she said, I don't want to come and stay if it's not inconvenient. But apart from world-class malapropism, she could be good fun. And we met her off the boat and took her to see Rodney Dangerfield, who had Andy opening for him. Unfortunately, Andy sent on his alter ego, Tony Clifton, which was a character he played, an appallingly lush and offensive lounge singer. That night, he was particularly vile and incensed the audience, and then refused to leave the stage. I seriously thought there was going to be a riot. I'd never experienced such anger from an audience. They yelled and screamed abuse, and he would only taunt them further. Poor Rodney Dangerfield. When they finally dragged Tony Clifton off, he came on to a cold and angry audience. I went backstage to say hello after, and he was shaken and furious. Never again, he said. I'm sort of with him on that. My kind of insult comedian was Don Rickles, and he and I played separate heads of a two-headed dragon in an animated film called Quest for Camelot. We improvised happily for days in a recording studio, and they used not one single word. The movie tanked. The strange things kept happening. Pink Floyd record producer Bob Ezrin invited Tanya and me to visit him in a studio in Provence, the very evening Roger Waters was recording his lead vocal for Another Brick in the Wall. Just him, just us. Timing. We don't need no education. Well, actually, you clearly do, or you'd say any education. We hung out a bit with Roger in France. I thought his idea for the Wall tour, where they literally built a wall between the performers and the audience, was one of the most brilliant theatrical ideas of all time. I still do, even though Trump has tried to steal it. More strange things. I stood in an elevator at Madison Square Garden after the Ali versus Quarry world heavyweight fight, face to face with Henry Kissinger. Next to me stood his burly security guard. Behind Kissinger stood Ronnie Wood, putting his tongue out and making silly faces all the way down, trying to make me giggle. Kissinger's security guard hadn't a clue what to do. Had anyone threatened his charge physically, his reaction would have been swift and lethal. But he wasn't trained to deal with a rolling stone mocking his client behind his back. We both stood side by side, desperately trying not to grin, pretending it wasn't happening. More strange things. Why was it me standing on a table at Tramp at 4 in the morning with Harry Nielsen, George and Ringo bawling out Valari at the top of our lungs, trying to drown out the next table of loudly singing Italian waiters? Someone had to do it, I guess. People seem amazed these days that we all knew each other, but we were all part of the same generation of post-war kids who grew up with the rationing and shortages of the 50s and conquered the world in every field in the 60s. Writing, art, poetry, painting, photography, couture, rock, and in our case, comedy. It was an amazing renaissance, as this brave new world was created out of the ashes and bomb sites of a world war that had just slaughtered 60 million. The strangest thing of all was that Elvis turned out to be a big Python fan. That was mind-blowing. He had meant so much to me and had saved our lives in the Offney. I now learned he took his guys to private screenings of the Holy Grail late at night in Memphis. Not only that, but he had all the tapes of our TV show on his plane. That Elvis should love something I did was the world turned upside down. I knew Elvis had a sense of humour. His Vegas recording of Are You Lonesome Tonight, where he cracks up after he changes a line to Do You Gaze at Your Bald Head and Wish You Had Hair, went to #1 in the UK. It's not so much the line as the lack of response from the Vegas audience that makes him unable to continue singing the song. He laughs helplessly throughout. It's still on my jukebox. What finally blew my mind, and I had trouble believing it, was when I met the delightful Linda Thompson, and she told me that Elvis would make her sit up in bed at night and do Python Pepper Pot voices with him. They would screech loudly in middle-aged English female voices.
Oh, hello, Mrs. Thing. Hello, Mrs. Entity. How are you, then? I need a new brain. Well, why don't you get a new Carrie's brain, then?
He didn't. No, I refused to believe it. I made her tell me 3 times before she finally convinced me, and then only because she knew the phrase Carrie's brain. No American would know that reference. It still amazes me. If Elvis had been alive today, he would be your stalker. He loved you guys so much. He particularly loved the Nudge Nudge sketch. He called everybody Squire from it. There were only 3 TV channels, ABC, NBC, and CBS, and when they went off the air late night, he would make me sit up in bed and do Python sketches with him. I still can't really believe that Elvis, the one who saved our lives at school, was such a fan. Chapter 14, A Very Naughty Boy. From the moment Monty Python's Life of Brian opened in the summer of 1979, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life began to take on a life of its own. To help promote the movie, it was released as a double-sided single, paired rather oddly with another of my songs, All Things Dull and Ugly, a parody of the rather bland Victorian hymn, All Things Bright and Beautiful.
All things dull and ugly, all creatures short and squat. All things rude and nasty, the Lord God made the lot.
It got nowhere, of course, but then our singles never did, though the evolutionary biologist and author Richard Dawkins reprinted the lyrics in his book The Greatest Show on Earth. When the film opened in California, Harry Nielsen and Timothy Leary were going mad for Brightside, and Harry told me he was going to record it for his new album. The recording sessions went on for days, culminating in an all-star celebrity chorus. I have never been one for spending hours in the studio, so I was less than happy to sit around listening to someone doing overdubs on my song, even if it was Donald Duck Dunn. In fact, I wrote a waspish little song of my own called Harry. He's a pretty nifty guy, always looks you in the eye. Everybody passing by will sigh for Harry, which includes the little stinger, Here's a little gentle song, ding-dong, a sort of sentimental song. At least it didn't take us very long, Harry. We recorded it at Redwood Studios in a single day, with John Dupre producing and my lovely singer-songwriter friend Charlie Dore singing along with me. John and I had begun working on The Life of Brian with the Otto song, and we would spend the next 40 years working together. We did many Python songs for the Contractual Obligation album, recorded about 6 for The Meaning of Life, produced Monty Python Sings, and wrote several musicals before eventually having a Broadway hit with Spamalot. John was the most perfect partner you could ever wish for. He did everything I couldn't. Effortlessly. Once we were recording I Like Chinese. Damn, I said. What? Asked John. If we'd thought ahead, we could have had it translated and sung a verse in Chinese. Well, said John, I only speak Mandarin. While he filmed Popeye with Robin Williams and Shelley Duvall, Robert Altman had had the insane idea of taking rock musicians with him to Malta to work on the movie's soundtrack. This led to legendary drug excesses and predictable madness on that Mediterranean island. Amongst the ringleaders was Harry. Now we sent Derek Taylor off to hand-deliver our new song, Harry, to its eponymous subject. The gift took him completely by surprise. Harry responded like a child at Christmas. No one had ever given him such a present. A song about him. He played it to everyone on the movie, and then for everyone on the island. He couldn't get enough of it. So fond was he of this little song that not only does his version of Brightside close his final album, he actually opens Flash Harry with me singing my song Harry. That's right, I open a Harry Nilsson album. Sadly, Flash Harry was only released in the UK at the time. It will be another 30 years before it was released in the States, along with a fine documentary film, Who is Harry Nilsson and Why is Everybody Talking About Him?, which features my little ditty. There were many nights of madness with Harry in Hollywood because he liked a good argument and a good drink. And when Harry turned up on your doorstep, people often disappeared for days. Not me, I hasten to add, for I had my own bright side by my side. In fact, Tanya says Harry offered her a huge plate of cocaine at a party at Timothy Leary's house when she was 8 months pregnant. She pointedly gestured at her enormous stomach. Harry said, oh, sorry, love. On another occasion, he accidentally knocked his own toddler into the pool. Oops. Harry never really recovered from the Beatle praise from John Lennon. Harry Nilsson is our favourite group. But he certainly wrote and sang like an angel, until all this boozing and schmoozing and smoking and snorting finally put paid to his golden voice. And in the end, far too soon, it put paid to him. He died on the eve of the 1994 Northridge earthquake, which struck in the middle of the night, while he was lying in his casket in an Agoura Hills funeral parlour. When the 6.7 trembler hit, he was thrown clean out of his coffin. A perfect Harry thing to do, still falling off the stage. Brian opened to huge controversy. Tanya and I were supposed to fly Concorde from Paris for the opening of the movie, but the night before we were due to leave, 1,000 rabbis suddenly appeared on the streets of New York protesting the movie. 1,000 what now? Everyone seemed puzzled. Didn't they get the memo? The rabbis went away as quickly as they had appeared, and were replaced by angry Christians, who picketed the Burbank studios in L.A., claiming that Warner Brothers were the agents of the devil. Though everyone knows that's CAA's job. Bob Daly and Terry Semel stood firm. In fact, for them, it was a blessing. These controversies were on the TV news. We were making headlines around America every night. There was no need for us to fly to the States and do publicity. There's only one thing you can't do, and that is stop Americans watching what they want. Hey, even pornography is called freedom of speech. So while the movie was being pulled from cinemas across America, people would simply drive across state lines. This pattern repeated itself everywhere. Half of the UK banned it, and the other half flocked to it. Sweden advertised it as the movie so funny that Norwegians weren't allowed to see it. One nice footnote to the Brian controversy. In our movie, Sue Jones Davis, a Welsh actress, played Brian's revolutionary girlfriend Judith. She was fiercely naked in one of the scenes. When the movie was first released in her hometown of Aberystwyth in North Wales, the local council banned the film from public screening. 30 years later, she became the mayor of Aberystwyth and overthrew the ban. Isn't that great? Thanks to all the fuss and protests, the movie did extremely well at the box office. But after this madness, I ran away for a while with the lovely Tanya. I was tired of fame and sick of being recognised as Monty Python.
Hey, Monty!
Thank heavens we didn't call it Wither Canada, or people will be yelling,
"Hey, Wither!"
at me. We fled to France, where for many years I remained anonymous, just this wacko Brit who lived on a hill in the middle of nowhere. I'd bought a little property with Lynn in 1971, thinking I could write just as badly in France as I did in London. And now I bought her half from her. It was really only a glorified cowshed with a bedroom, bathroom and tiny kitchen. But it had beautiful terraced views over the Var, with ancient olive trees and a pine forest at the top and bottom of the hill. We'd had the place for 8 years with no electricity, and even had to find water, hitting a crystal clear source 80 meters below the ground. Tanya and I now decided to build on behind our little chateau. We called it the House of Brian. Who could fail to love Provence? Lavender, rosemary, fennel, thyme, and a wind so furious it has its own name, Le Mistral, which sweeps the sky clean of clouds, taking all meteorological depression away and lifting the spirits and filling you with energy, but then stays for days, banging away like an old quarrel, grating on your nerves, making you irritable and cranky. But then, one beautiful morning, it stops, and the sun shines and the countryside twinkles. It's like magic. When I first discovered the Var, it was officially the most underpopulated département in France. There were hardly any French. It was mainly Spanish and Italians, and a few Piedmois, Algerian colonists, who had fled from Algeria. Of course, I didn't make it easy on myself by buying a property with no road, no water, and no electricity. Sometimes I feel I experienced all stages of civilization, and that was a good thing. No water? A farage. No electricity? Oil lamps. Music? Cassette batteries. No cooker? Gas bottles. No fridge? Camping gas. No road? I'll hump the gas bottles in a wheelbarrow over the terraces. No shade? I'll plant trees. And fires? You bet. We were burned twice in forest fires, once in 1979 and once again in 1999. Shortly before Électricité de France came bringing electricity, poet Stephen Spender had given me his magic lamp, a superior pumped-up oil lamp, from his home in the Alpes, on the day he got electricity. Now we two were being connected, and I no longer had to hump up the hill in the cold, dark night and attempt to start an outboard motor to fill the cistern. Of course, the water always ran out at night. Sod's Law is written in French. Everything stops, everything breaks. I used to call it Fuck Provence, to the intense delight of my fellow-suffering, equally obsessive neighbour, Richard E. Grant. Another acquaintance was a very tall, blonde-haired man who could often be seen pushing around one of his first inventions, a wheelbarrow with a ball instead of a wheel. He and his lovely wife Deirdre and their delightful children were poor and very thin. She taught art and even sold some jewellery to help him build an improbable vacuum cleaner that no one wanted. He was, of course, James Dyson. You have to be completely obsessive to have a house in Provence. After Brian, I took a long sabbatical, immersing myself in astronomy, learning about the immensity of our universe, and generally self-educating myself in cosmology. I spent the nights gazing at the unbelievable number of stars wheeling overhead in the Milky Way, and wrote a lyric about it. I also read life science books, trying to understand evolution and the extraordinary appearance of life in the universe. I could understand the physical universe expanding and banging away, but why does life evolve over billions of years to become you and me? This opened my mind to the central question of the universe. What is life? To my mind, nobody has yet answered this question adequately. Well, all right, Professor Brian Cox did. But we were both pissed at the time, and we've completely forgotten what he said. Steve Martin, a philosophy graduate, said that life exists so the universe can experience itself. In France, friends came to stay, I played guitar and read, and now and again the odd python would drop in. George and Liv visited, Paul Simon and Carrie Fisher came to stay, Paul sitting in the garden writing lyrics. One day, Art Garfunkel drove up on a motorbike with Penny Marshall and gave me a long ride down to the coast through the Gorge du Verdon. My first time on a motorbike. David Bowie came to visit. P. People loved the rustic simplicity of Provence. I also wrote a play. I'd built a dirt floor shack in a pine wood up the hill, and every morning at dawn I would walk up with a thermos of tea. I'd finished the play, and we were going back to the UK for a couple of weeks, when Tanya asked me to read it to her. So I went up and brought it back down. Just as well, because while we were away, the whole forest burned down in a devastating fire. When we returned, nothing remained of the forest. The shack was gone. Paradise looked like the Somme. The smell of burnt wood was everywhere. But Tanya had saved my play. In 1982, Pass the Butler, directed by Jonathan Lynn, toured the UK, and then Michael White brought it into the West End in 1983. On opening night, a lady said to me, just before the curtain went up, "Well, now let's see whether Tanya did right to save the play from the fire." Nice, with friends like that. Pass the Butler ran at the Globe Theatre on Shaftesbury Avenue for 6 months to howls of laughter, and only closed late in the Falklands War when people stopped going to the theatre entirely. Early on in that war, "Always Look on the Bright Side of Life" was sung by the crew of the destroyer HMS Sheffield, while they sat on the deck for 3 hours awaiting rescue from their sinking ship, after being hit by an Exocet missile. It was also sung by the crew of the stricken HMS Coventry, and they particularly enjoyed the ironic line, "Worst things happen at sea, you know," an ad-lib of mine from the play-out. I found this very moving, and also when it was sung by RAF Tornado pilots, as they suited up to fly dangerous, low-level missions during Operation Desert Storm in the First Gulf War. What had started off as a caricature of a wartime song was now a real war song. One odd footnote from the Falklands. Michael White, the producer of my play, had a dinner party at his Edgerton Crescent home, and Koo Stark entered to a flash of paparazzi. Meanwhile, her boyfriend, Prince Andrew, slipped over the back wall, aided by his protection detail. I was seated next to him and found him to be quite charming. When I asked him what he was doing, he said he was in the Falklands flying helicopters. "Geez," I said, "what exactly do you do?" "Well," he said, "it's my job to fly around dropping chaff to lure the Exocet missiles away from our ships." "Let me get this straight," I said. "The Queen is your mother, and you've got the job of being a decoy for French missiles." "That's right," he said. "Thank Christ I'm working class," I said. Michael White was always funny, and at one Cannes film festival, Tanya and I played a little trick on him. He was employed by Vanity Fair to go to all the parties and take pictures of the stars. We watched him going from table to table, clicking away. This was pre-digital time, and cameras had real film in them. And because they were on a tight deadline, Michael's unprocessed film was rushed to New York at the end of each day. During the party, I noticed that Michael had for once left his camera on the table while he went off and schmoozed. I looked at Tanya. "Come on," I said, seizing his camera and setting off for the gents. Giggling naughtily, we took a series of semi-pornographic selfies of a couple apparently having sex in a stall, without, of course, showing our faces. We then returned to the table and put his camera back. We tried hard to keep a straight face when Michael returned to collect it, but he didn't seem to suspect anything, picked it up and went off in search of more celebrities. We could hear him going, "Nicole, Tom, over here, click, click, click." Safely back in our hotel room, we laughed and laughed at the thought of Vanity Fair processing and reviewing the footage. In the middle of all those glittering stars, they would suddenly come across our porny pictures taken in the toilets. We laughed at this for many years, though without ever telling Michael. It still makes me laugh. Michael Chalky White was for many years a fixture at Cannes, where he would play tennis in carefully torn shorts. Once he served a double fault and said unforgettably, "Sorry, I wasn't ready." Chapter 15, The Bollywood Hole. In September 1980, Monty Python ran for 4 nights at the legendary Hollywood Bowl, where we played to 8,000 screaming fans a night, a wild and crazy crowd best summed up by my line in the Bruce's sketch. "It's a typical Hollywood audience. All the kids are on drugs, and all the adults are on roller skates." Drugs were everywhere. Not just grass. Cocaine was abundant. You couldn't go to a record company meeting without some executive saying, "Let me take care of your nose." Hollywood made several movies at the time, which can only be understood in the context of cocaine. In 1979, searching for a venue for Python to play in L.A., I was shown several possibilities by a young, hip, tightly jeaned executive from a major live event company. We went into the Pantages Theatre on Hollywood Boulevard in the middle of a performance of The King and I. Yul Brynner was on stage. We walked through the auditorium, and the young man talked normally to me as if there were not 2,000 patrons sitting in the dark spellbound. I marvelled no one seemed to notice. Then we went to the Ford Theatre, an outdoor venue, where the village people were on stage, and the scent of amyl nitrate filled the air. Finally, we ended up for dinner at Carlos and Charlie's on Sunset across from the Chateau Marmont. A slight drizzle had begun, and as the executive pulled into the valet parking in his little silver Mercedes, he was rear-ended by the next arriving customer. "Shit, I gotta take care of this. Will you hold on to this for me?" he said, shoving a package into my hands. "Sure," I said, and walked inside. What was in the package he was so keen to get rid of before the police came? Did I know at that moment? The thought certainly occurred to me as I entered the restaurant. I decided it would be better to know, so I headed for the bathroom and opened the packet. I had never seen so much cocaine. I was looking at about 15 years. Steeling myself, I calmly went and sat down at the table and ordered a strong martini. Soon he returned. I shoved the package onto his knees under the table. "Thanks," he said. We did not go with that company. We went with Dennis O'Brien, who had figured out how to get a cheap Python movie out of us if we filmed our live performance at the Hollywood Bowl. We shot the show on a new 1,000-line Japanese video system, which we could easily convert into a movie. And our old BBC TV friend, Terry Hughes, from the Two Ronnies, came in to direct. The Hollywood Bowl was great fun, possibly the most fun we ever had together. We were spoiled rotten. George Harrison was there, Marty Feldman was there, Carrie Fisher was there, and Harry Nilsson was always there with Timothy Leary. Steve Martin, currently dating Bernadette Peters, threw us a party at his house, where Michael Palin was slightly embarrassed by a topless girl leaping into the jacuzzi. I think he made some excuse about having to go off and read the Daily Telegraph. Uh-oh. Hello?
Hello. I'm sorry. That's just not true. That's absolutely not true. It wasn't like that at all. If you want the truth, then read my book, available in... £90. £5.50. Reduced in all good bookstores. And some bad ones, too.
Terry Jones made no such excuse, but plunged right in. To the water, anyway. Although with Terry, you never knew. He would always give a girl a decent chance. Marty Scorsese threw us a party at our hotel, where he was working on Raging Bull, impressing me beyond belief by holding 3 separate conversations at once. Graham, who had rented a house in Brentwood, threw a party for his parents. It became star-studded and raucous, and all of the Stones trooped in. There were slightly disapproving glances from elderly English people, and sharply at 10, Graham's parents suggested to the Stones that it was getting late and time for them to leave. They all took the hint and cleared off. "No problem, love," said Keith. It was probably still breakfast time for them. After the show, John Cleese and I stayed on to help Terry Hughes edit and adapt our 2-hour, 2-act live show into a 90-minute film for Handmade Films. It was going to get a theatrical release. Tanya and I lived quietly in a bucolic canyon. One day, Dennis O'Brien came over. He had been eyeing me suspiciously, concerned about what I might have been saying to George about his business dealings. I had indeed expressed some of these concerns to George. They were troubling. Now O'Brien told me I was fired from Monty Python. I laughed in his face. "Dennis, my dear, I think you will find you may cease to represent my financial interests, but you can't fire me from Monty Python. That's definitely not up to you. What will you do, sack a beetle next?" He was obviously very concerned that I was onto him, and that George would realise how corrupt he actually turned out to be. I think George must have asked him some questions and mentioned my name, for O'Brien to have responded so abruptly. I had to go,